the worker incurs debt. You know, they don't have a cent to their name and they're trying to access a job. And when they arrive to the port, oftentimes these guys or boys are thinking that they're headed for construction jobs, but they end up actually at the docks and they don't speak the language. They have no really idea what's going on. And a conversation occurs between their labor broker, the trafficker, and the captain. Captain needs, you know, three guys they got to clear out in 24 hours, and a negotiation happens. So they cut a deal. The captain pays that price, and essentially that captain now owns the labor of those individuals, in essence, those individuals.
Welcome back to Floodlight, a podcast from us here at the Anti-Slavery Collective. We're looking to raise awareness of modern slavery by sharing stories and speaking to interesting people that are looking to combat it in their own way. I'm Jules.
And I'm Eugenie. And for the last 9 years, we have been passionate about fighting against slavery in all its forms, wherever it is found throughout the world. Slavery is still very much a modern problem. There are currently more than 40 million people in slavery across the world today. That's more than any other time in human history. And those most likely to be affected by it are women and children.
This week, we caught up with Ian Abina. Ian is an investigative journalist and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Outlaw Ocean.
The Outlaw Ocean is one of our favourite books. It's based on more than 5 years of reporting, much of it offshore, exploring lawlessness on the high seas, including sea slavery.
So Ian, can you tell us where did the passion come from, or the idea, or what brought you to write this book, and what was your main inspiration?
I'm a journalist. I spent 17 years at the New York Times. I began a series there called The Outlaw Ocean, which is about, generally speaking, lawlessness at sea. The goal was to help the public reimagine that space out there, that two-thirds of the planet that's water, and not just think of it as this kind of liquid desert that you fly over shades of blue, but rather as a place that has, you know, more than 50 million people working out there and is a sort of vibrant economy and workplace, and also a realm that's largely ungoverned and where a lot of bad things happen. You know, in retrospect, I realize that things line up, but when you're driving it through your life, you don't really see it as a straight line or even a curvy line. You don't see it as a series of connected dots. But in retrospect, I do think that most of the stories I've covered throughout my career have been about, you know, people of various sorts, but quite especially ones that tend not to have a voice, be it sex trafficking of minors in the U.S., did a long series on that, or coal workers or truck drivers, or, you know, so I think there is a core interest in places and people that feel like they're hiding in plain sight. And so that was one driver. I think before I was a journalist, I was an anthropologist, and I spent some time, cultural anthropologist, and I spent some time on ships, and that exposed me a little bit to this, you know, diaspora, transient tribe of workers called seafarers, you know, and I was riveted by them and how important they were, but how rarely you heard from them. So that drove me to, and then just as an investigative journalist, you're always looking for virgin snow. You're, you know, it's so hard to find any topic that doesn't feel overdone. And, you know, there are obvious reasons why there's very little journalism coming from the high seas. But the fact was that there was very little competition, frankly, on these stories, because not many reporters actually get out there into the space and attempt to see what's going on.
It must be so hard to be on one of these ships. When we were reading the book, there's so many wonderful little anecdotes about how you slept in a hammock with the other boys. And obviously, as you were talking about some pretty dire situations, but it's pretty amazing to live on those ships. What was something that really tested your resolve?
I think two contexts come to mind. One is a more recent story where we were trying to get in or near North Korean waters to ultimately reveal the largest illegal fishing fleet ever. And we had to find someone willing to take us there. So we bought our, we being Fabio Nascimento, my Brazilian videographer, and I had to find, we bought our way onto a squid vessel. And this is a fishing vessel that we had just convinced to let us come on board. And it was just disgusting. And the crew at the last minute, the normal crew of the vessel refused to go because they were too afraid of the wrath of their own government. These were South Korean crew. And they were also afraid of who we were about to encounter, namely the Chinese. And so they, at the last minute, said, we're not going. So the ship wasn't cleaned up from its prior, you know, work. And so squid vessels are really gross. So that was pretty gritty. And I don't normally get sick on these trips, and I went seasick. And that trip I was sick most of the time, just from the smell and the rot.
How long were you out at sea for typically? How many days and nights?
It varied hugely. Like that South Korean, North Korean one was, we were at sea for only 3 days. But other stints, the Antarctic reporting, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Normally the trips took about 2-3 weeks. Often the trips took about a month and a half, but you're not at sea the whole time. You're out for 2 weeks, then you're dropped off someplace and you're getting a new vessel and you're out for another 2 weeks. That's the typical pattern.
And on the whole, how well were you received onto these boats?
You know, I mean, the majority of the boats, there had been a lot of negotiation on the front end, so it's not like we were a surprise guest. The sea slavery reporting we did on the South China Sea was wholly different, whereby we were, you know, talking our way onto boats. We were just showing up and convincing captains to take us on board. And the skepticism on those type of boats was very high because we just appeared. And no one understood quite why we wanted to be out on their vessel. And those are the vessels where you really had to take a lot more time. And then some of the patrol boats in Indonesia, we went out on a patrol with Indonesian officers in a situation that got very violent, very dangerous, you know, armed conflict between the Indonesians and the Vietnamese. And a guy had been taken hostage and, you know, lots of stuff went down. They'd opened fire. They had to run away from the Vietnamese. There were a lot of things that for military macho men were not necessarily something they had wanted an outsider to see. You know, you give a couple of, you know, 2-3 days of not asking a single question, not really saying much at all, just being present. And usually people start opening up.
That's something I learned from your book, is that you did say that. You said if you just are present, you keep silent, they learn to sort of trust you. But can you go back a bit and talk about exactly what sea slavery is and your experience of it?
You know, slavery is such a charged term. I don't know that this is academically vetted or even the norm among advocates, but in my research and in my reporting, the way that I defined the spectrum of slavery, specifically sea slavery, was these are typically captive workers, and their captivity, or the, which some will call trafficking, in the settings where I'm looking at it, so off the coast of the Falkland Islands, off South Korea, off the coast of Ghana, the spectrum of scenario that defines the captivity runs from debt bondage. So if you want to, it's a terrible term, but if you want to talk about the sort of softer end of the trafficking spectrum, you have less overtly coercive means. You have debt, right? And these are typically Cambodians, Burmese, Laotians that with help from a labor broker is how they call them in the region, but these are traffickers. They take them across the border, promise them a job. In the passage, the worker incurs debt. You know, they don't have a cent to their name, and they're trying to access a job, and they accrue debt. And when they arrive to the port, oftentimes these guys or boys are thinking that they're headed for construction jobs, but they end up actually at the docks, and they don't speak the language. They have no really idea what's going on, and a conversation occurs between their labor broker, their trafficker, and the captain. The captain needs, you know, 3 guys they got to clear out in 24 hours, and a negotiation happens. Trafficker says, hey, look, I incurred $1,000, $500 debt in bringing these guys in. So they cut a deal. The captain pays that price. And essentially that captain now owns the labor of those individuals, in essence, those individuals, you know. And so that's the one end, you know, that's a standard debt bonded situation. The guy goes on the ship, he goes off to sea, and, you know, he stays there until the captain says his debt is paid. The harder end, more kind of a, overtly course of his, you know, just straight up kidnapping, you know, and shackling of workers and demonstrative sort of performative murder and beatings of other workers to show what the stakes are if you attempt to escape, you know, the severe acute violence that enforces enslavement exists as well in this labor pool. And so sea slavery is that spectrum of scenarios, and it all transpires typically on fishing boats more than cargo boats, and in a bunch of places around the world, it's a pretty prevalent problem.
Sea slavery as well seems to be rarely talked about. Why do you think that is, and how can we as an organization change that and shine a light on sea slavery as a specific form of modern slavery?
So I think there are a bunch of factors that make this not as known as it should be, you know, in no particular order. One is the demographic of who gets enslaved. You know, the largely white, wealthy Western consumer of news, of products, of what have you, tends not to be the victim of this sort of abuse. And therefore, and those who are from typically developing global South nations, often rural, illiterate, smaller settings even within those nations. And so the victims, if you will, the survivors, those who are captured by it, tend not to have a voice, right? They don't have lawyers, and they're not in touch with, you know, reporters, and they don't have organizations that are local to them who speak their language and find out about this stuff. And so that's one of the big reasons that I think it's hidden. I think another reason is that this workforce, this place, is unusually removed. You know, you find people that are locked in a factory in the Amazon or in Cleveland. You know, once the word gets out that there's a bunch of adults or kids or what have you being held against their will in a workplace, you know, journalism tends to follow pretty quickly thereafter. These ships are way over the horizon. And even if word later trickles out about what's going on there, the crime is already long since passed.
Yeah.
And it's far away as well. You know, there is also the thing of international waters, right? It's like, who's responsible for them?
Right. I mean, I think, so the list goes on, right? So there's one, which is the geography of how far from land. There's the other, which is the jurisdictional complexity of the nature of the crime scene, right? So the crime scene is a ship. If you think of a ship almost like a Dickensian factory, it's not like a Dickensian factory because it's not in South London, you know, stationary, where folks can spot check. It's a moving factory. And in that factory, you have five different nationalities. The owner is from one country. The captain and the officers are from another. The ship is flagged to a third. The workers who are captured are from a fourth. And they're heading from the port in a fifth and heading to a port in the sixth. And the product on board is going to a seventh. Okay, so what government actually has jurisdiction or cares to do anything about it? It's tough, right? It's tangling. And then they're in the waters that are not belonging to any particular nation quite often. Sometimes they're in national waters, but often they're on the high seas or international waters, which makes it even murkier. So the jurisdictional issues and the nature of the workplace where the crime happens is another factor. The last one I would cite is there is something very distinct about fishing. The culture around this kind of work and this workplace historically has always been given a pass when it comes to modern labor laws, etc. And that has, I think, made it even more difficult to counter these kinds of abuses as different from other kinds of industries.
Gosh, it's so complicated, isn't it? But I think the great sort of, I don't know, floodlight, as this podcast is called, or the big spotlight that we're sort of talking about, is that you can use your voice and what you've learned to, you know, your job and your career and what you've learned to do to shine a light on things that are happening out there.
So Ian, the book talks about the incident, I think it was in 2014, when a mobile phone was left behind in a taxi, or in the back of a taxi in Fiji, and it triggered this international outcry after the phone was discovered and it showed a video of four men being murdered out at sea. Can you tell us a bit more about this story and the fact that, you know, it was such a coincidence that that story got uncovered, and how we can do more to uncover more of these stories and get greater visibility on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I would recast the rendering a tiny bit. The core is right. So there's a mass murder, essentially, of at least four, possibly seven men. It was captured on a cell phone camera. The cell phone was left in the back of a taxi. Someone found it, saw the footage, handed over to the police. And then that footage and that incident sort of went silent. The footage was handed over to Interpol and some other police agencies. And I had a source at Interpol and said, who said, you need to look into this. I know you're looking into crimes at sea, and this is unusual because you rarely have footage that not only has the crime itself, you know, in black and white and red in this case, but also witnesses and possibly culprits celebrating and posing for selfies at the end of the video. So this should be, from a law enforcement standpoint, a slam dunk. You know, it is a clear murder. The men in the water, maybe they were pirates before, but at the time of the filming, these guys were unarmed and not a threat. And so it's very hard to make this murky, you know, as so much in life becomes. This is a black and white case of murder. And so now it's a question of who's going to do anything about it. And that was the most galling thing about it, because we spent a year at the New York Times investigating this and pieced together a lot of new information, put it on the front page of the New York Times, biggest newspaper on the planet, and could not instigate governments to act, neither the Fijians nor the Taiwanese, who were really the parties who should have acted. But, you know, I kind of became obsessed with the case, and so did a couple of sources of mine who were really working hard on it. And 7 years later, to jump to the end of the story, we put a new piece on the front of the Washington Post, because I had since left the New York Times. And it took a long time and an incredible amount of pressure. But finally, the Taiwanese government captured the captain who ordered the killings and convicted him to a 26-year sentence. But it was a kicking and screaming that any government was willing to do something. And it was largely the embarrassment of this becoming such a high-profile case. And that was much credit to the New York Times, quite frankly. The footage had floated on the dark corners of the internet, you know, for a while, but no one was really doing anything other than gawking at it.
And that, dare I say, is the power of the media in the most positive way, that it can really bring stories like that to a light that otherwise are being hidden.
I think so.
And Ian, The Outlaw Ocean isn't just a book, it's also, you formed the Outlaw Ocean Project, haven't you? Which is a non-profit journalism organization, right?
That's right.
Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that sounds amazing.
Yeah, gladly. It's my pride and joy. I mean, I left, sadly, I'd only ever spent my career at the New York Times, and then but I didn't want to put this line of reporting down. And so I decided after the book came out, and a year more at the Times, that I was going to step away and try to continue pursuing these stories, because there were so many I hadn't gotten to and so little journalism happening. So created a sort of, you know, a nonprofit journalism organization. It's modeled in many ways after ProPublica or the Marshall Project. You know, these are sort of similar boutique outlets. What we do is distinct in a couple of ways. Number one, our focus area is, you know, anything that happens offshore, you know, but quite especially human rights, labor, environmental crimes at sea, anywhere in the world. Number two, we write the stories and we self-fund them through a bunch of means, because these are really expensive to produce. And then we take them first to a tier one venue. So we have partnerships with a bunch of places, published at the Washington Post and the New Yorker and the New York Times. And we take them a piece and we say, hey, look, here's a piece. It's been, you know, edited and extensively reported and fact checked. And, you know, we've got video, we've got stills, we've got everything you need. you're not going to own it though. You can publish it. We'll give it to you for free. You can have it exclusively for 2 weeks, but then we're going to take it back and we're going to translate it into 12 languages. And then we're going to send it out to the world to 45 other newspapers and magazines around the world. And we're going to get it seen by all those audiences and all those other languages. And we're going to maintain. And the reason we're doing that is because we want more people to read it. We don't just want the New York Times or the New Yorker, you know, audience to read it. We want it to really have an impact. And that was what I thought was one of the biggest things that was limiting the impact of public service investigative journalism was the exclusive model, you know, that it just runs in The Guardian or it just runs in BBC. So we broke that model. And then the next thing we do, that's sort of third life. First life is tier one venue. Second life is all these other venues. And then the third life is converting the journalism into some other medium. So music, podcasts, animated series on Instagram, video game, just lots of mural project, like really strange conversion of the journalism into some other medium that stays true to the spirit of the journalism, but attempts to get at a different type of audience, younger, more international, through different channels. So, you know, the music commandeers Spotify and Pandora and Apple Play and turns them into journalism outlets, you know, by wow. using music as a way in to it. So, and that's been incredibly fun and strange and successful.
It's brilliant that you've used really sad stories in here, but you've taken it and you've run with it and you've built it into a whole nother level that can just keep going further and further to inspire change. And
yeah, how do we keep the momentum?
Those who are consumers of this stuff, how do we, I think thinking of that, those people, that demographic in lots of different ways. So like that person, my mom, you know, she's a taxpayer, she's a voter, she's a reader, you know, she's a buyer of stuff. She's a donor. She, you know, gives money to causes. She's an interlocutor. She's someone in conversation with her friends and her partner. And, you know, so everyone has like lots of different hats that they wear. And if you think of in each one of those capacities, what little things you can do on one issue, you realize that you actually have 20 roles and you can do lots of things, you know, on one cause, not just, you know, one thing, not just change your eating habits or your buying habits, but also make a point of talking about this issue, make a point of donating to these guys. You know, like there are lots of different things you can do. And I think that's a really important strategic point.
We always say, ask the question, you know, when you read a book like The Outlaw Ocean or you watch a documentary, you learn something, but don't just sort of absorb it and let it go. Then think about your daily life and the questions you can ask, because if it's too good to be true, it normally is. And yeah. It's been amazing the response we've had from people from talks we've done. And, you know, we'll tell them about an app where you can report something. And suddenly people do think about things differently and look mm-hmm. at things differently. And it really does make a difference.
I agree.
I think it's, for me and Jules, I mean, I speak for myself here as well, but reading The Outlaw Ocean has definitely given a whole new aspect to what I think of the ocean and also what I want to do to help it when I'm on it. You know, it's we got to protect what's there. And as you say, 2/3 of the world is pretty amazing. We have to, you know, keep an eye on it and make sure that things are happening well for everyone.
Yeah, and it's not just about protecting our fish, it's about protecting our people as well. There's, as you say, Ian, there's a huge amount of lawlessness that's happening out in the ocean that none of us are aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think also the point, Jules, you made earlier about, you know, seafood is just one supply chain. We could be talking about, you know, bottled water or, you know, whatever, couches, you know, the modern, I think, so taking a step back and not getting locked into these problems as being distinct to the ocean, but rather a systems analysis that says, like you said, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. Like the notion of hidden costs everywhere we turn and sort of what's contributing to what allows for the continuance of dark hidden costs, that's a systems analysis. That explains, that connects climate change, the hidden cost of dumping carbon into the air as if it's a bottomless trash can, to sea slavery, the hidden costs of sea slaves that bring us tuna for impossibly cheap prices. These are hidden costs. They're the same thing. You know, so I think like encouraging folks to think even deeper about the fundamental things that are wrong with how we consume is, you know, important.
Ian, thank you so much for coming on our podcast today and telling everyone about the Outlaw Ocean, which is one to read, I must say. Everyone, please do download it or buy it or whatever. But it's a wonderful book, and Ian's a brilliant writer that really opens your eyes to the world of the sea. But thank you so much, Ian, for your time. We really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Floodlight. And an even bigger thank you to Ian for joining us. Make sure you buy his book, Outlaw Ocean, to read more of his fascinating and important work. Join us next week for our final episode, and one that I'm particularly excited about, where we will be joined by Dean. Dean is a former paratrooper from the British Armed Forces who now works in international security. I was lucky enough to meet Dean when visiting the Ukraine-Poland border in April of this year. He has spent a lot of time in Ukraine and Poland over the past few months, surveilling and intercepting traffickers at the border. He tells us what it's really like fighting modern slavery out in the field, what we can all do to support the effort back home, and the impact it has had on him personally to see this trafficking happening with his very own eyes.
You can also be an activist and join us in the fight against modern slavery by visiting our website, theantislaverycollective.org. And if you want to learn more about what we've discussed on today's episode, head to the show notes and follow the links. Our mission is to raise awareness about modern slavery, so please help us by sharing and posting about the podcast.
Please make sure you subscribe to Floodlight, and please also take the time to leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you about the show, your own activism, and who you want us to speak to in the future. See you next week.
Floodlight is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.